The date is the 16th of July, and this is an interview with Major.
Well, I finished up the war as a half colonel.
Oh, did you? Yeah. Oh, fine. Lieutenant Colonel F.W. Kendall, K-E-N-D-A-L-L. Now, what I'd like to do, if I can, there's more here, I believe, than just a good part of the chapter for the biography approach. I'd like to get a little bit on your own background, first of all. You're a Canadian.
I was Canadian, resident in Hong Kong pre-war. And I became attached to the British Secret Service, which was then under the Ministry of Economic Warfare in Hong Kong. I was a field operative for them there from the outbreak of the Pacific, of the European War up to the outbreak of the Pacific War.
Oh, I see.
I was doing undercover intelligence work for several years before the Pacific War started.
That since, from 1939, roughly?
1939, yeah.
What business were you in yourself?
I was at that stage, I'm a mining engineer by profession, and my business, I had a consulting practice out in the Far East, based from Hong Kong, and my business fell on its face when the Japanese moved into South China, you see, they cut off all our work.
Oh, yeah.
And I was then working for the government in charge of refugee camps, actually building and maintaining refugee camps for all the thousands that poured across the border when the Japs moved in.
When you say working for the government, you mean the Chinese government?
No, the Hong Kong government.
Oh, I see.
And I used that as a cover job, you see, for the underground work that I was doing.
What sort of undercover work would you be required to do at this time?
Well, I was responsible for the installation of radio network communications and agents and operatives, both in Hainan Island and the Canton area and as far north as Taiwan, which were all occupied by the Japanese, you see.
Mm-hmm. Well, you would certainly...
And our organization was, it was not subversive at that stage, it was purely intelligence.
Yeah.
We're gathering information, reporting by secret radio sets and things like that, back to Hong Kong.
Yeah.
And then I trained a group, a stay-behind group in Hong Kong, which was called the Zed Special Force. This was on behalf of the British forces there, and our role was to... create diversionary tactics when the Japanese came in. We were planning it long before they actually crossed the border. And I had a whole group of Europeans who had been specially trained. We had a training camp then in Singapore. And I went to the camp with one of my men. We came back and set up this camp in Hong Kong to train these men on how to live on the country and whatnot. And we created a series of dumps in the hinterland area back of Hong Kong and in the new territories. And then when the Japs moved in, our role was to live behind the Japanese lines and report what was going on and sabotage where we could.
Well, now, how long before Hong Kong would this occur? Were you preparing for the fall of Hong Kong?
Oh, we trained for a year before.
Is that right? I'm thinking right now in terms of the that Canadian brigade that came in.
Oh, long before they came in.
Yeah. It was pretty well realized that...
Firmly established, and the less said about them, the better, because that was a hopeless proposition, absolutely hopeless.
Well,
I don't even like to talk about the Canadian effort there, because that was bad from the word go.
Is that right?
And the men were ill-equipped. They were not used to that type of training. They didn't fit in with the garrison troops. As you recall, they were garrison troops from Bermuda, mixed with prairie boys who had never handled a gun.
Yeah.
And they all arrived in Hong Kong literally weeks before it happened, and there was no preparation, no training, no nothing.
Yeah.
In fact, most of their supplies didn't even arrive.
Yes, this is what I gather.
And then they were armed with weapons they weren't accustomed to and weren't used to, and it was a hopeless thing. It was absolute chaos. Mind you, they did a good job, but they didn't have a hope. Not a hope.
Were you surprised that they came?
We were all very much surprised that they came, but we were horrified when we discovered that they were so ill-equipped.
Yeah.
It was an effort, mind you, but it was an effort made too late. Had they arrived a year before, it might have been different. Yeah. They'd have assimilated some training. They wouldn't have stopped the Japanese, there's no doubt about that, but they'd have made a much better show of themselves. They were a fine bunch, too. I knew all their officers, senior officers and whatnot. They were a grand crowd, but working with absolute negative material.
Yeah. Just to just play.
They didn't know one end of a gun from the other. And they just walk right smack into a war. At least the boys who went to Europe had months, some of them years of training in the UK before they went across, but these boys had nothing.
Yeah.
They never fired a shot in anger in their lives. And our garrison troops, unfortunately, weren't very much better because they'd been there too long.
Yeah. Well, now, after Hong Kong fell, how did you get out? Or were you
I was asked to return, you see. When the Japanese moved across the border, our men were already in position. So the Japanese came through and we were behind. I was asked to come back. And myself and one of my chaps came back through the Japanese lines into Hong Kong defense. And then we were cut off. We couldn't get back to join our men. So I was attached to GHQ in Hong Kong on patrol work, anti-sabotage work, and whatnot in Hong Kong during the fighting.
Mm-hmm.
And then a week before Hong Kong fell, I was asked to prepare an escape route. Mm-hmm. We had 5 MTVs there, mm-hmm. all fully equipped and whatnot. And the night of the surrender, we took out I was a leader of that group, we took out these 5 MTVs. With about 70-odd people on board, mm-hmm. key personnel from government, and key military personnel, people who could tell the story of Hong Kong outside.
Right.
My job was to get them through the Japanese lines into Chinese territory, which right. I was able to do.
Uh-huh.
In fact, we all got out intact, never even saw the Japanese.
Where did you go from Hong Kong? I mean,
we went Hong Kong up, around Hong Kong through Mers Bay, and we landed in Chinese territory there in a sector that was controlled by Chinese communists. There were no Japanese there at all.
Oh, I see.
And the Chinese communists looked after us and got us through the Japanese lines up to Weichao, which was then in free China,
mm-hmm.
with the nationalist Chinese troops there. And then from there we went on up to northern Guangdong and eventually trickled up Guilin up to Chungking and went out that way.
Ah, I see. And then you go down there, if I remember correctly, down to India.
Yes, I was sent to India and I opened up a guerrilla trading school outside of Pune. And this is where this Force 136 came in. Force 136 was a part of SOE.
Oh, yes.
The Special Operations Special Executive.
Right.
And General Gubbins was the number one of the whole show throughout the whole war, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And they had headquarters in London and Baker Street. And they controlled this type of operation all over the world. But our whole operation in India was under Mr. McKenzie. We were all civilians, most of us.
Mm-hmm.
And we had very large training facilities there, and we formed various groups. There was a China group, there was a Thailand group, there was a Malayan group, there was a Singapore group, and a Borneo group.
How big a camp was it?
Well, we put through hundreds through our camp, and I did most of their basic training in these groups together, and took them through the ropes and taught them how to survive in the jungle and, you know, guerrilla warfare training, sabotage, small arms, all the rest of it.
Where would you learn all this? I mean, you were a civil engineer.
Well, I learned it because I had formed this group in Hong Kong first, you see.
But where would you learn it from there?
Oh, God, we just picked it up, reading Mao Zedong's books and various other things.
Is that right?
We had this training camp in Singapore that had been set up by the UK government, a secret camp, and we went there, my number two went down there, and we took the full basic training course there, and went back to Hong Kong and established a similar operation in Hong Kong.
Oh, I see. You had taken this training in Singapore, went back to Hong Kong, established it there, and then it's when you leave Hong Kong through China and get back to Pune that there you establish this larger camp.
Established this larger camp, and then I was in India for a year on that work. And they sent me back to the UK, where I went through all the schools there, including the forgery school.
Lovely.
And,
lovely.
I'm an examiner of question documents right now as a result of it. That's another story, anyhow. But
can I break in just for a moment here? When you were by the time you were at Pune, now you say you were there for about a year.
Yeah.
By this time, I assume you would be part of the military forces.
I was a civilian in charge of military. All the men under me were military, except some of the groups who were civilian.
Mm-hmm.
The first group we trained were all Indian communists. The second group we trained were all Malayan communists.
Mm-hmm.
And this famous Chin Peng, you know, who's caused all the trouble in Malaya, he was one of my boys. I trained him.
Go
on. And we used natives with communist tendencies because they were the only ones we could depend on. They were the only ones that had any coition among themselves. Thanks, I have my own. So it was an interesting operation all the way through.
What about the language problem?
Well, we had language experts, and we had officers attached in every case who spoke the local languages. You see, we recruited men from all services, any man who'd had service or training language, particularly in the Far East pre-war, was drawn into our organization. They were volunteered for it, of course. So all our country sections were headed by Europeans, not always British, but Europeans, Dutch, Danish, Norwegian, various other nationalities, who were fluent in the particular language of the country. And they had this group among them, you see, and the nucleus of the group were the officers, and then the men were people that were either brought out or were already out, who volunteered to go back in again.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, as I say, most of them had communist inclinations, but they were damn fine men to work and train with.
Well, I suppose the reason for this would be their own communist dedication to the job. Which,
that's right. So they were excellent. The Indian communists were the finest group I ever trained. And this Chin Peng was a brilliant man. And when the Malayan War started, some years after the war ended, I was asked if I would take part in putting him down, and I said, "No, bloody fear, he's too well trained for me. I'm not going after him," and I stayed out of it. I wouldn't go back then. Actually, I was getting a bit old for jungle work then.
Well, this would be, as you say, in Malaya.
Yes, in the 40s, in the late 40s.
Yeah.
In the early 50s.
Lovely. Well, then, you go. What brought you from Pune to London? They sent
for me to go back, and because we were planning and discussing various operations in the Far East, and I went back for that purpose. And then we discussed in detail the type and kinds of training that people would be required, and I was required to see all the European section training to extract from that what we could use, my group was formed under the name Oblivion, code name Oblivion. And the role there was to come to Canada and recruit Chinese from Canada.
Whose idea was that?
Originally, I'm afraid it was mine.
Mm-hmm. And of course, that'd be logical, you being a Canadian.
Yeah, being Canadian. And it was taken up and carried through. And I was then over here, leader and head of this particular mission, this group.
Well, now, just to get the role here as straight as I can, you would suggest it to your immediate superior, who would be whom, or do you remember?
That was the Far East, then the Far East section. That was then the Force 136, which covered the whole of the Far East.
Mm-hmm.
And their number one in London was Mackenzie was the number one in India. The number one in London, I think of his name, but I don't remember.
Yeah, I might be able to find it, I don't know, I may or may not.
Well, there's been quite a history written. The history of the Far East was never written up, but all the SOE other operations were.
Yeah.
In fact, when the war ended, we were required to destroy practically everything.
Yeah, that follows.
It was a pity in a way, because we had up-to-date information and intelligence and all the people that were aiding and assisting the Japanese, but they decided, well, let's wipe the works, so all our records were destroyed.
Well, you say that the idea of training Chinese communists was given the code name of Operation...
No, the men from Canada weren't communists at all. They were
We
ran out of Chinese.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
We couldn't get Cantonese speakers in that particular part of the world.
Mm-hmm.
They just didn't exist with the Cantonese dialect as spoken in the Hong Kong area.
Mm-hmm.
So I came here, and even then we had difficulty finding fluent speakers to the point where we had to actually hold Chinese lessons for these Canadian Chinese boys to brush up their Cantonese.
The code name for this idea and for your movement, you say, was
Oblivion.
Operation Oblivion.
Yes.
Well, now, how does that tie in with this code name MONSP?
MONSP was not a code name. It was the designation, the War Office designation given for our entire group. It was actually a mailing address, MONSP.
Oh, I see.
And that was the central functioning location, and there was a minister sat in that particular post who was over all of us.
Mm-hmm. I see. And it filtered on
into the SOE section, which General Dubbins was the head of.
Mm-hmm.
They had the Norwegian section, the French section, they had the Middle East sections, and the Egyptian sections, and all the rest of it came under direct SOE.
Well, now, once your idea had been taken up, first of all, or even before that occurs, can you give me an idea of a date, even a month, when this would be?
Yes, that was in 42. It was the spring and early summer of 43 that we were actually at Penticton.
43. So the idea would be how quickly between the time that the idea was taken up until you were there? That would be late 42, would you say?
It was late 42 when we planned the operation, mm-hmm. and it was early 43 when I first hit Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
And the boys started congregating from various parts of Canada, some of them out of the army, some of them civilians who volunteered for this work.
Well,
and we assembled in Vancouver, I think it was in April. It was April 43. Over
well,
the camp.
How would you go about organizing it? Now, you say that once the idea was...
Well, we had British NCOs sent over. I had a British major sent over who was a communications expert. And we had five British sergeants, all specialists in their own particular field on armed combat, weapon training, explosive demolition, and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And they formed my nucleus instructor group, you see.
Mm-hmm. But how did the government go about collecting the Canadian Chinese?
That was done through Perkson and Allen and the, I suppose, somebody in Ottawa. Pearson was our contact, I remember that.
What would he be then? Was he?
He was liaising between the British government and the Canadian government on this type of operation.
Oh, was he?
Because we had an office. We had a man in Ottawa attached there, and we then had our head office for the Americas in New York.
Who was the chap in Canada? Do you remember?
French name.
But this would be sort of a contact office for the SOE in Ottawa.
Ottawa. And our liaison was done through this office and through Pearson, who was the only member of the government set up in Ottawa that really knew anything about us at all.
Now,
and then Perks, I presume, was told by the powers that be that this was a secret operation and must be maintained that way. He provisioned us and supplied us and handled everything. It was all withdrawn and disappeared kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose he had a blanket permit for that kind of operation. Of his staff officers, only his G1 and G2, and Colonel St. Louis, who was head of communications in the Pacific Command, were the only people that knew us. We ever had any direct contact with. The headquarters was then in the old Vancouver Hotel.
Yes, yes. Well, when you came out to Canada, incidentally, how did you come? By boat or plane or what have you?
No, I took a boat to Halifax, actually, and then... Mm-hmm. Went down through the States by train. I picked up my wife in Los Angeles and brought her up to Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
I'd had permission for this. We had a plan of using her because she's Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
Never actually went in, but she did the full training course.
Mm-hmm. And you would come up then and report him, first of all, to the two Perks.
Well, it was rather funny, actually. I was a civilian, strictly civilian.
You were still at this time?
Oh, yes, 100% civilian. And wearing civilian clothes, furthermore, and passes coming out of your ears, no rank of any kind at all. And my people in London said that when I went to Canada, I had to adopt a rank and go into uniform because of my work for the Canadian Army. So I said, okay, and they left it entirely up to me, of course, and I got to Vancouver, and I went to the Hudson Bay Company and bought my first uniform off the rack. And I went down Robson Street, second-hand store, and I bought British Army buttons, which I had sewn on in this uniform, to differentiate me from a Canadian soldier. I thought it was funny. And I said, well, hell, I don't want to be a lieutenant or a captain. I might as well start off as a major. And I put major's crowns up, and then I went to headquarters and introduced myself, and I was accepted as major. And until yesterday, Perks never knew that I was a phony. He laughed like hell about it.
Ah, he's
there. To make a long story short, when I got to Australia, I found that being a major wasn't good enough. I couldn't get the in that I needed, so I made myself a half colonel. And put the extra tip up. And I got away with it down there. Oh, there was hell to pay, but I got away with it.
Well, what about your identification and all that sort of thing?
I had old papers galore and passes. I still have a pass signed by General Perks allowing me access to any military installation in Canada, for that matter. Major Kendall.
Well, when you this would be the first time that you reported into Perks in yeah. uniform as a major mm-hmm. in your first uniform. Did you know how this would look?
Well, I had a pretty good idea because I'd been living in Army messes all this
yeah.
period, you see.
Yeah.
And outright to the end of the war, I was paid by the Foreign Office. I was under Foreign Office salary.
Did anybody ask you for identification when you came in?
Oh, I had everything. I had all the papers and documents that I needed.
As a major?
No, as a civilian.
But did it?
Well, Perks was told that an officer was coming, you see. That's all he was told. The officer turned out to be me. An officer by the name of Kendall, I don't know where it was.
An officer by the name of Kendall. And then you went in and presented your ID. Now, did he have anything
set up? He gave me ID cards, everything.
Oh, did he?
Oh, yes.
Did he have anything set up, or was a camp set up for you?
No, nothing was set up at that stage. It all started from scratch, but it moved off the track.
Well, who selected the site?
Well, I had a rough idea of where I wanted to train, because as a youngster, I used to spend my holidays down in the Penticton area picking fruit.
Where were you born, by the way?
Vancouver.
Oh, I see.
So I made a quick trip down there first, and our contact there was the number one of the provincial police in Penticton. He'd been brought in on the scheme.
What was his name, do you remember?
Person, I think it was. I forget his name. He's probably dead or retired by now. He was elderly then. So we rented a launch, and we went up the lake looking for a spot, and we found a spot just at the bend of the lake, mm-hmm. you know, where you turn to go up the Kalumahan. Mm-hmm. And it was on the opposite side from Summerland, no roads or anything, absolute wilderness.
Mm-hmm.
Enough beach area to set up a tent camp, and we moved in there.
Mm-hmm.
Absolute virgin country, but it was wild as wild can be. And it was perfect for our work, of course.
Yeah.
But we rented a big launch, and that was all done for us. And we had one Canadian officer attached to us. No, Canadian NCO, that's right. The kind of general boatman and factotum and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And he provided our transportation back and forth between Penticton and brought us provisions, supplies, and all that sort of. But anything we asked for, we got within 24 hours, there was no question about it at all.
How big was your camp? How many men did you have?
We had 26 men under training. We had a staff of 5, 6, 7 instructors, including myself.
That'd be yourself and, shall we say, half a dozen British NCOs.
Yeah. We have 4 or 5 to get there.
And the Canadian Chinese that you had, I suppose these would vary from some who had some military training and others who had absolutely none.
We didn't want them with military training at all, you see. We had to undo their military training as fast as we could. The type of work that they were doing, which was to be infiltration. Going into an area by submarine and act as civilians, and look like civilians, and function like civilians.
Yeah.
The whole purpose of it.
And what kind of training? Well, first of all, how long was this group trained?
3 months.
Just 3 months,
yeah,
eh?
3 months. Very intensive course.
Mm-hmm.
And then we followed it up with practical work outside. We were given a big, great big motor launch from the government fisheries or some department. That was turned over to us, and we went and blew up the Squamish, and we went up to Powell River and burned that place to the ground. We went up as far as Prince Rupert, playing havoc up and down the coast. You know, all practical attacks on various things. And
mm-hmm.
Usually the Navy was told that a Navy group was operating in their area, not to use live ammunition, that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
And we had fun and games there, and the boys got a lot of very sound practical experience from that operation.
Yeah.
That was a wind-up of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. What sort of things would you be training? You mentioned, I believe, communications would be one.
That's yes, they were trained in the use of that, what was then the latest agent's operating set, mm-hmm. the little tiny suitcase-type transmitter receiver. Very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it had almost a worldwide range.
Good.
The very latest thing.
Mm-hmm.
They were trained in the use of that. It was all Morse code business.
Mm-hmm.
No voice in those days. They're all tropicalized, as best as you knew how at those times.
Mm-hmm.
They were most efficient, actually.
And what
piece of... Then they were trained in sabotage, and the use of explosives is very heavy in that.
Mm-hmm.
And the
the idea of demolition work going up to the point where we are sinking ships and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm.
Were they,
we had tons of special toys and special explosives and timing devices and all that stuff, the very latest stuff that UK had produced.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, nobody in Canada had ever seen any of our stuff at all. The Canadians weren't trained in that ever in this part of the world.
How would the group be trained to operate? There were at least two, maybe three people per group. You know, once you did.
Well, I was going in with the group alone, and my idea was to hold up and hide out, and that was all prearranged. You see, that wasn't too difficult.
Yeah.
But we had a British Army group operating down as far as Whitechapel throughout the whole of the war. That was only 100 miles away.
Mm-hmm.
We had a contact.
Mm-hmm.
And they were to be our contact there, but my job, my role was just to go in and lay low, complete their dogs, and just be a guiding spirit, you know, and mm-hmm. dictate targets and things like that for these boys.
It surprises me a little bit that you could have a temp camp of that nature during the war in the Okanagan, and despite the fact that you say the provincial police played a role in guarding the camp, but there wasn't the...
Well, people knew there was something going on. To have people in Summerland were rocked out of their homes occasionally with their explosive charges. But they were just warned by the police, stay away, this is a secret training area.
Exactly.
That's all they were told.
Now, what about the...
Nor did anybody ever come near. They did. If the odd fisherman came near, he was whisked away very promptly. He got a shot of automatic ammunition across his bow, and he turned and buggered off as fast as he could.
Oh, I
know. Nonsense about that. We just kept him away. Nobody could come to the overnight.
Well, this is what I was wondering, if they had maybe had a police patrol boat sort of out in the water all the time. Or
we killed ourselves.
Yeah.
After we'd shot at a few boats, the way the word got around very quickly.
I imagine it would. Well, now, you were trained there for roughly about 3 months. Incidentally, before we leave Penticton, this came up, of course, when Perks mentioned how he visited the camp.
We invited him down. This was, we were more than halfway through training, and I was very proud of the progress that these boys had made, so we put on a special exhibition for him,
mm-hmm.
a midnight attack against an encampment from the prisoner's truck, and we had the whole bloody countryside booby-trapped in one way or another. So we invited Perks up, and he came. We were surprised when he accepted that he came with his ABC, just the two of us, and he stayed with us for 3 days, I think it was. He was fascinated, although he was thrilled. It was like a Boy Scout that we were using stuff that he'd never even heard of before. And of course, we showed him everything and illustrated everything. We took him through our war games and blew the hell out of him and kicking and stumbling over explosive charges all over the place. We loved it. Oh, he was back in action again, you know.
Oh, marvelous.
He didn't want to leave. He was pressing business that got him back to Vancouver. We could have kept him there.
Probably taken him into China.
He fired all our weapons and he made up his own explosive charges and he fitted his own timing devices. He just one of the boys while he was there.
Yeah. Do you remember this occasion that he mentioned one time? I think he said he was sitting around the fire with the group at night and he promised the
Well, we were needling him. All the time he was there, we were needling him. And I was the needler,
yeah.
Needless to say, and I kept saying, well, here you see what a representative bunch of Canadian boys can do. I said, they're all Canadian citizens. One wasn't actually, one hadn't been nationalized. He was our cook. He went along with the party, too. And I said, these boys have volunteered for this particular work. They're going on a particularly dangerous mission. Their chance of survival is very slim and all that stuff. I said, don't you feel that citizens like this are entitled to some recognition in a country as big as Canada?
Mm.
By God, you're right. By God, you're right. And then he started talking to them. He'd sit around the campfire in the evening, talking to them and digging in deep, you know, their feelings. And one of our bright boys was Doug Jones, who later became an MP.
Mm-hmm.
And he hadn't even finished school then. He went back to law school after the war.
No, yeah.
But he was very articulate and very outspoken, representing the BC Chinese. And he was absolutely fearless, and he told Perks exactly what the Chinese felt. And we had several others, one from Toronto, we had one, two from Montreal, I think, all coming from Chinese communities in our major cities. So each had something to say, and then when the thing got really ripe, why, Perks really took interest in that. And he made him a promise then and there. He said, well, if anything I can do, he said, I'll devote a lifetime to see that you get the vote. And when he became a politician, it was one of the first things he did.
Yeah, that's quite true. There were no Canadian Japanese, there were Japanese Canadians in the Nupatal.
None at all. We couldn't possibly use them because of the language problem anyhow.
Yeah.
We didn't need a knowledge of Japanese.
Mm-hmm. Well, after the after you completed your training in the Okinawan, I believe you said that you yourself go first.
I went off to set up a camp further, in Australia, and we had a we moved into a what had been